Welcome to the Religious Studies Project, hosted by David Robertson and myself, Christopher Cotter. This podcast is produced in association with the British Association for the Study of Religions, and you can visit our website at www.religiousstudiesproject.com.
Today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Timothy Fitzgerald, who, aside from being my supervisor, is well known for his books, The Ideology of Religious Studies and Discourses on Civility and Barbarity. He has done extensive research in India and Japan and is one of the key members of the Critical Religions Research Project. And today he is going to be talking about religion, non-religion and mystification. So, Dr. Fitzgerald, welcome to the Religious Studies Project.
Thank you, Jonathan. Could I just, first of all, also add my most recent book to that?
By all means, go ahead.
Try and boost the sales a bit, you know. Religion and Politics in International Relations, The Modern Myth. So on the question of religion, non-religion and mystification, the term religion, let's confine ourselves for argument's sake to the English language, since we're speaking English and most of what we're doing is in English. Probably most of what one could say about the term religion in English would apply pretty similarly to Dutch, German, French and maybe some other European languages, but each language has to be historicized in its own terms. So confining ourselves to England and the English language, my argument is that the term religion, for most of its history in English, and we're talking mainly about the post-Reformation period, because before that an awful lot of stuff was in Middle English and Latin and so on, so the picture was a bit different. But after the Reformation, the term religion, when it was used, almost always seems to refer to what I would say call Christian truth, i.e. it was often expressed as our Protestant faith, but there was no internal differentiation between a religious and a non-religious domain. Because truth can't be divided. It's a different logical discourse from the modern one. So everything was encompassed by truth, by Christian truth. And that included the ecclesiastical courts and the civil courts, for example. That was not a division between religious and non-religious. The civil courts had their fundamental duty was to assist the ecclesiastical courts in tracking down heretics and punishing them. The king, for example, the sovereign, he was not a non-religious secular figure. He was an anointed king, which made him in a way a kind of a priest. So these divisions were done differently. Now the question is, where did the modern concept of religion emerge, and why did it emerge, and how is it different? And I'd say that, first of all, the modern concept of religion is pluralizable. Truth is never pluralizable. There's only one truth. So when you can start talking about religions in the plural, then you know you're moving into a different kind of logic, a different kind of discourse. And we can follow the emergence of that discourse, and it goes through various stages. But fundamentally, we're talking about a kind of an objectification of religions as objects which can be set up and compared alongside each other. They can be counted. And it's only in this context, this new context, that we would ever think of calling Christianity a religion.
Now, you've mentioned how there's this modern discourse. When does that emerge for you? When do you think it really becomes apparent that religion becomes pluralized out of this notion of Christian truth?
I think it's happening, for example, during what came to be called the Wars of Religion, which was basically Protestants against Catholics. And you get a number of different churches all claiming to be Christian, Calvinist, Lutheran, and so on. So you get a multiplicity, and in that context they start to be called religions in the plural, meaning confessions. They're all Christian confessions, but they're different claims on interpreting the truth of Christianity.
So even at this point, it's still a very European-centric discourse that's going on. It's not necessarily a result of encountering Islam, or what we now call Hinduism, that's promoting this discourse and the changing of the concept of religion.
Well, let's just try and get a little bit of historical perspective here. I reckon the first time that I've come across any very clearly explicit distinction between religion as a private faith on the one hand and the state or the governor as separated from religion and not actually necessarily having anything to do with religion is around 1680. And I find a very clear statement of that by William Penn. And William Penn, interestingly enough, went on to found Pennsylvania. And he had a great interest in writing bills of rights and sort of state constitutions. And so he was one of the first people to actually create a state constitution, the Pennsylvania state constitution, which was very liberal in terms of toleration and nonconformity and so on. Yes, and another would be John Locke, who also, in 1689, in his work on toleration, he makes this very clear distinction as well. But it seems to me that the idea of a non-religious state does not really become a serious proposition in England for a lot longer, because the Anglican Church was really a church state, and you could argue that the Anglican Church state, with various degrees of strength, continued until the First World War. I mean, some people would say that the act of toleration, when there was an act of toleration at some point in the 19th century where Catholics were allowed to go to Oxford and Cambridge, and also nonconformists, you could argue that that was an important state in the kind of breakup of the Anglican church state. Another aspect of this is that the new discourse on religions in the plural also brings with it a discourse on the non-religious secular. So this is, it seems to me, to be a very important historical emergence of this idea that there are non-religious domains. That's just as important as the idea that there are religious ones.
Now then, you're talking a lot about England, and in England, the case is that religion is very much a totalizing concept. What about when, before England was England, because you mentioned how your discourse starts, like when England is formed as a country of its own right, what about before then? Because if we go back to like the Latin roots of the words like religion, I mean, are you saying that your argument applies further back as well, and that there was no distinction?
No, I'm not.
Back then, or should we be working with a different concept of religion when we go before England, in a sense?
Well, you see, I'm not sure that there was a... You see, this is the problem when we talk about a concept of religion. When we today, in contemporary language, talk about a concept of religion, we presuppose that we're talking from a non-religious ground, or that that non-religious ground is available, the secular university. I mean, here we are in a secular university, and so what we're doing is objectifying religions, so they're things that can be talked about and described and analysed and so on. And that is actually the condition for the invention of religions, the invention of the non-religious secular from which you can observe them. Now, if you go back to the Catholic period, I don't think that there's any corresponding concept. Of course, historians argue about this, but I'm not a medievalist, nor do I know medieval Latin. But I would refer to Bill Kavanagh's book, The Myth of Religious Violence, and he does some very interesting historiography on, first of all, Roman religio, which is usually claimed to be the etymological origin of modern religion, and then medieval religio, and then early modern religion, and then modern religions in the plural. And he argues that these are all quite different concepts and that they operated quite differently within their own contexts. So, for example, he argues that religio in medieval Latin was a kind of minor virtue for which the major virtue was justice. So religio is a minor virtue in relation to justice, but it doesn't have anything like the modern sort of essentialized or reified sense of there being lots of different religions in the world. As for Latin religio, well, again, I'm not a Latinist, and I'm sticking my neck out here, and of course I would defer to any Latin scholar, but my sense of religio in the Roman context is that it was more of a ritual term, that it applied to doing something with the right attitude. So you show devotion to Rome religiously, if you like, because your mind and heart is focused on it. It's of serious import to you. Or you might perform your own household devotions to the ancestors or the deity or whatever, religiously, with the right attitude of devotion. So I'm not sure about this, but my feeling about Roman religio is that it was more to do with a certain kind of attitude of seriousness and attention to detail. It had a feeling also probably of public, you know, the public celebrations, for example, which one ought to attend to because it's in the civic spirit and so on. And in this case, I don't think that religio demarcates a separate domain, but much more a set of attitudes. Filial piety, for example, a whole range of attitudes which require seriousness and attention to detail.
I mean, it's interesting you say that because you do have the Latin word religio, but there's also the Latin word politicus. And part of your argument, as I found it in discourses on civility and barbarity, was that certainly in England, there was no distinction at a certain point in time between the religious and the political. Yet, if we go back further in time to a pre-Christian era, there was certainly a different demarcation between the two domains.
Well, I'm not sure if that's true, actually. I mean, but okay, can't argue with you too strongly about Rome. But certainly, if we're talking about 16th century England, I don't think there was a non-religious political domain separated out from something called religion. They didn't even have a word politics, as far as I can see, in the sense of referring to a distinct domain of human action. They had an adjective or an adverb, politic, which again referred to the way, the kind of spirit in which you performed your duties, or the spirit in which you took decisions about important policies and so on. So politic referred to things being in their right place, things being productive, things, you know, a policy conducive to well-being, to the harmony of the Commonwealth, the flourishing of the Commonwealth. Church rites could be politic or impolitic, depending on whether they were conducive to the enlightenment of the worshippers, you know. So I certainly think that in 16th and indeed in 17th century England, and arguably the attempt to create a political domain as separate from the church was in a way an ongoing struggle for people. There were a lot of people who wanted to do that, but the power of the church state was extremely strong, so it was a conflict of interest, probably.
And part of your argument also is that this has had an effect on religious studies as we do it now. in the, because you mentioned before that we are in a secular university and therefore we think of religions in the plural, and does that then mean that we have a problem that when we look back at 16th century England and we think in terms of this pluralized religious notions, that it's we're kind of mistaken in the way that we're looking at 16th century England because the concept didn't exist back then?
Yes, exactly. And I think it was in the process of production, if you like. And the problem is that we're at the end of that process of production, and then we retrospectively project backwards the end of the process onto periods of history where it was only in formation. One aspect of this which I think also has to be brought in is that we're talking about a period of history when Europe, Christian Europe, is beginning to expand in terms of colonization, plantations. And this introduces a whole new set of circumstances into the internal developments in Europe. So I don't think that the internal developments in Europe, such as the Reformation, the conflicts between Protestants and Christians, the development of markets, trade, wealth, banking, all of those things were happening from the 16th going through into the 17th and 18th centuries in a big way. So the process of colonization and plantations must have been a very important factor in the changes that were occurring within Christian Europe. So what kind of problems and opportunities do plantations and colonies offer? Well, they must have offered escape for people who want to develop new forms of life. That's obvious. You get a lot of radical Protestant groups fleeing from Britain, the British Isles to North America. You get land, a whole new quantity of land and the possibility of developing land and doing stuff with land, and all the other things like minerals and growing stuff and all the items that were brought back into Europe from South America, from North America, also of course from the East Indies. So I think that the whole colonial setup must have had a very important part on the developments within Europe. And I think this also applies to the way we classify things. If you're taking over a colony, if you're invading somebody else's society and you want to control it, then you obviously have to be able to classify what's going on inside. So you need information about the natives and about how they organize their world and what language they speak and all of their different institutions. But you also need to be able to classify things, and so you get the development of Enlightenment classification systems. Obviously a lot of these were to do with the development of the natural sciences, but human beings were also being classified eventually in racial types. But I think one particularly interesting issue is what got classified as religion and what didn't in the colonies, because increasingly you see the term religion being used as though it is a neutral marker. I would say that most of the uses of religion and religions dating from the 17th century are ironic, in the sense that when Christians said they have no religion, what they meant was they have no Christianity, they have no Christian truth. What they might have is something which looks vaguely like religion, you know, some kind of crazy superstition, but nevertheless you can see that there are certain analogies between what they do and what we do. So the term religion then becomes more useful in a kind of neutral way to try and peg off some of their institutions as religious ones. But then what happens to the ones that are not classified as religious? You see, what's their classification? And I think that this is part of the origin of the religion non-religion division.
And you've mentioned this sense of irony in this original usage of the division. Is this irony continuing in a certain respect? Are we still being ironic in the way that we are using the terms religion and non-religion, even if we're not entirely aware that we're being ironic when we do it?
Yes, I think so, because I think that actually there are two major discourses of religion in the English language which still continue, but they're not usually analysed out. So every time we do a kind of religion speech act, as it were, it could be read in two different ways. It could be read that we're talking about a kind of neutral classification of certain practices which distinguish them from non-religious practices, like state practices or like market practices or work or whatever. Or it could mean that we're really talking about Christian truth, which a lot of people still are. I mean, let's be clear that there are still lots of Protestant missionaries, evangelical missionaries, who are trying to convert people they consider pagan and who they call pagan. The word is still used by some kinds of Christian missionaries. They include in pagan Catholics. I've read a very interesting summary of the sociology of missions in Mexico a couple of years ago, and there was very good evidence that United States-based missionaries going into Mexico were targeting the self-sufficient village, peasant villages, and they were targeting also the Catholic churches, which are often embedded in these villages. I mean, Catholicism is pretty much embedded in Mexican life, as I'm sure you know. So Protestant missionaries go there to try and break up these communities and link them into wider markets. And I think that the language which they use is still very much a continuation of the older discourse on religion as Christian truth, the opposite of which is paganism. Yep. And irrational.
But, does that mean then that you've got this one trend of understanding what religion is as Christian truth? Does this other trend that you mentioned of this simple classification that this is a religious thing and this is a market thing and this is a politic thing, has that managed to divorce itself from this other trend, or do you see it as kind of being fundamentally undermined, or in your opinion, should we even be doing that kind of basic religious classification?
Well, I don't think we should, but you see, I think the problem is what actually is the common factor in all the vast range of practices which are classified as religion? I mean, when you think about all the different things which are now called religion, what holds them together, apart from their kind of residual position as being not part of the state, not part of the economy, or not officially part of the economy, not part of politics? They've been kind of marginalized into this sort of ghetto where you get a vast collection of different kinds of practices from all around the world, which have nothing to do with each other at all, but they're all called religion. So what is it about religion that gives them this sort of common factor? Well, I think then you have to look at the historical origins, and you see that actually it was Protestant Christian truth.
So this is where you talk about mystification. There's this sense of mystification in that religious studies as it is now has picked up this what you call a liberal ecumenical theology from its origins, and it's now carried through into religious studies. Are you saying that religious studies cannot get rid of that mystification at all, and therefore we should get rid of religious studies completely?
Well, first of all, the fundamental point about mystification is that the invention of religions is really the invention of scientific rationality, which is taken as the base of the secular, the non-religious. And so by inventing religions, you're able to mystify what is really an ideology itself. We'd have to ask ourselves about what ideology lies behind the secular. But I would say that basically secularity is itself an ideological concept. The fundamental mystification is when so-called secular institutions and practices, and amongst those I would give as an examples the modern nation state, capital, self-regulating markets, education, the idea of a secular education, secular universities, secular law, and so on. So I think that all the idea that all of those institutions, because they are not religious, are therefore rational and commonsensical. They are reality. I think that's how the effect is achieved. So they're as it were, the idea that there's a special class of faith-based practices lends the idea that there are another class of empirically knowledge-based practices, you know, practices in the real world rather than the other sort of mystical world. It gives it a kind of luster of common sense factuality. And I think that that's where the fundamental mystification is. Because actually, I think that self-regulating markets are themselves myths, as much a myth as any god that ever was invented, you know.
But you've now just referred to the self-regulating market, which we view normally in secular terms as a myth, which is a very religious word to use. It's religious terminology to think of. Even mystification itself has a certain religious connotation to it. So are you actually really deconstructing the category of religion at all, or just expanding it to include the capital markets?
No, I think if you can see capital markets as having as big a mythological element as the Catholic Mass, for example, then what that tends to do is to level the playing field, as it were. So what you have is a whole family of human practices and their typical values, and that family of overlapping resemblances does not give us religion as distinct from non-religion. What it gives us is a continuum or some other kind of, you know, way of thinking about human practices. But I don't think that it continues the idea of a religious rather than a non-religious domain. I think that I am partly trying to use words tactically or strategically, deliberately, in a way which makes one question what one would normally take for granted. So if I say that, you know, self-regulating markets are myths, I could use the word fiction. They're fictions. They're collective fictions. They're acts of the collective imagination. And they've been institutionalized, and in the process of institutionalization, they've developed an aura of common sense factuality.
Just picking up on that notion of fiction there, does that mean that the person who believes in God is also participating in a fiction? I'm just trying to understand, are you going to be fair that if you're going to talk about free markets as a myth, and God as a myth, and then you say free market is a fiction, surely then you should say God is a fiction as well.
Sure, yeah, I do. I think, you see, God, what is God? We use this almost completely empty term in our everyday discussions as though its meaning is obvious. But actually, God... What a Catholic means by God and what a Greek Orthodox means by God may be importantly different in certain respects, to the point where, you know, they might have burned each other to death for their wrong views. And Protestants again. I mean, Protestants were being burned to death by Catholics, and Catholics were being burned to death by Protestants. Clearly, they didn't share the same concept of God. What does God mean? I think God is also quite clearly an act of the collective imagination of particular people in particular historical circumstances, in particular cultural situations. And the only way that we can understand what people mean by God is to actually look at what they say God is, and that means looking at their various theological theologies and so on. Now, obviously, if I'd said that God was a fiction in, you know, in the 17th century, I probably would have been burnt at the stake.
You might still be, considering the way religious studies works in certain areas. Just before you move on, what I want to pick certain trends in religious studies would fundamentally deny that kind of attitude that they deny that you're allowed to say that God is a fiction, that saying God is a myth is the most politic word to use, and fiction is derogatory and also has its own kind of metaphysical standpoint in that respect. How do you view yourself in terms of that relation, in terms of the people who would say that you are now explaining religion away rather than merely observing it?
Well, I'm certainly not a Christian believer. I was brought up as a Christian. I was brought up in the Church of England. I've got a lot of ordained ministers in my ancestors, you know, going back to the 17th century. But for various reasons to do with my own, you know, my own biography, which are not necessarily very interesting, but and which are probably not that much different from an awful lot of other people who became disillusioned with the church. I never really believed in Christian doctrines like the Trinity, or, you know, if you're going to say I'm a Christian and I believe in God, then presumably you have to have a position on, is God three in one? I don't think that most Christians who say they believe in God necessarily think of God as three persons in one. I don't know. I mean, perhaps they do, but it's quite difficult to do it. And I can also see the Muslim argument that the belief in three gods in one is really polytheism. Which again, I'm not necessarily against polytheism more than monotheism, but nevertheless, if you're claiming to be monotheistic and you come up with this Trinitarian doctrine, you've got to work very hard to keep people convinced.
You just mentioned your own personal experiences there, and I'm not intending to go into that in detail, but I'm just wondering, does that then mean that as scholars, do you view us as being incapable of ever really being able to get out of our own subjective experiences and ever achieving some sort of neutrality when we look at things? Can we only ever look at things and think that is right or that is wrong? Can we not just look at things as things?
Can you give me an example?
You were talking about how, like, when you're thinking about Christians and how they have the Trinity and the Muslim argument against that, that's therefore polytheism, and then your own experience of saying that you don't understand how God can be three in one, yet at the same time there are Christians, even hypothetically only, out there who do believe that. So
I think the important point here is to keep our eye on this term God as a general category. There are lots and lots of different ways that this term gets interpreted, and there are lots of different theological positions, but the term is also used in the plural by anthropologists, by historians and so on, to talk about gods all over the world, you know, the gods of Hinduism, the gods of Japan and the gods of Africa and so on. Again, it's a bit like the term religion. If so much can be described as God or gods, what meaning does the term have actually? And what function does it have in public discourse? What is the point of going on using this term God and trying to translate it into every language in the world?
Well, maybe moving away from the term God, you just mentioned theology there. Would you say that your own position in saying that you don't believe in the existence of God is itself a theological position, and therefore, I guess what I'm trying to say then is that there is nobody who isn't theological. It's impossible to have a non-theological perspective on things, even if that theology is simply that there is no such thing as God.
I think it's probably impossible not to have metaphysical elements, including values and principles, involved in any worldview. When I said I didn't believe in God, I mean I don't believe in the Christian Trinitarian God. Generally speaking, I don't know what God means. That was my point. It's in a way I don't see how one can believe in such an overused category. After all, kami in Japan is translated as God, but you know, kami can be used in such a wide range of different contexts that if you want to understand how somebody's using the term kami, you have to actually look at the specific situation that they're in when they're using it to get the meaning, because it might have, you know, for example, it can apply to not only to the emperor, but it can also apply to a waterfall or a mountain or to the North Star or to powerful human beings or to hijiri, who are like ascetics.
Okay. But in that case, putting aside God as kind of like a contentless term, you've now listed all these examples. Are you saying, is from your position as a scholar, you are then going to fundamentally deny the existence of such things and then try and explain why those people believe in those things from other perspectives?
No, I would say that as a scholar, my job is to look at the way they use language, to see their, to look at their discourses, to see how they imagine the world. And I think that's very important, to understand how people imagine their world collectively and what values and principles are implied in those discourses. So that is a very important job. The problem is one of translation, and it's also one of using Eurocentric Christian derived categories to try and found a so-called science of religion on.
Okay, so if we accept that we should be getting rid of religious studies in a certain respect, many of the people listening to this will be in religious studies departments. So where should we be moving to from here?
You keep using the word get rid of, and I've heard people saying abolish and so on. I may have used that term, but fundamentally, we cannot get rid of this vast public a discourse which is being reproduced by politicians and tradespeople and civil servants and by church ministers and, you know, theologians themselves. I mean, this discourse is so permeating that the first thing we have to do is to acknowledge its power, the fact that it's a globalizing discourse, that everybody now needs constitutions which have some kind of, you know, distinction between a non-religious secular state and a religion or several religions or whatever.
I mean, it's more of an institutional question rather than a conceptual question, because we can study these concepts like religion and non-religion in other departments like sociology or anthropology. Yet religious studies sits on its own from these. So if these other departments are all talking about exactly the same thing, should we have, on an institutional level, religious studies departments, or should we be more diffuse amongst other departments?
I think the religious studies departments, insofar as they exist, should be deconstructing their own discourses, looking at how they arose historically, what purposes they serve beyond the conscious intentionality of any particular scholar, and also look at the way that religion discourses are being reproduced throughout the arts and humanities. Because this is certainly not just about religious studies. I take religious studies just to be a kind of very concentrated form or a very concentrated specialist department in the production of discourses, which is actually permeating the whole of the humanities. Because as you quite rightly say, people in English studies, historians, anthropologists, they're all claiming to be finding out information about religions and using these categorical schemes without really critically thinking about it very much. If religion departments could start being very self-critical and then start acting as the centre for changes more widely, drawing attention, for example, to social scientists, concerning the way social scientists construct this mystified object, or historians and so on, then I think you can begin to get a much more self-critical movement within the humanities as a whole.
I think on that note we'll finish there. Thank you very much, Dr. Fitzgerald.
Right, thanks.
You've just been listening to Jonathan speaking with Timothy Fitzgerald of the University of Stirling. As you know, every week we publish response essays on the website to these podcasts, and the response this week comes from Liam Sutherland, who also wrote the response to Graham Harvey's podcast a few months ago. It's quite a coincidence, really, because the last time I was on a train with Liam, we were going down to Canterbury to a symposium entitled What Does It Mean to Believe?, organized by Dr. Abby Day and the British Council. And on the train, Liam was reading one of Timothy Fitzgerald's books. At that symposium, I recorded next week's podcast, which is with Dr. Ariella Kazar, who is a demographer based at Trinity College in Massachusetts, speaking on the broad topic of what do Americans believe. As ever, you can download this podcast and all others through iTunes, and please, 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 if you do, give us a little rating. It'll get us back into the iTunes charts. You can find us on Facebook, on Twitter at Project RS, or on the website, of course, there are comment sections as well. We would love everyone to use these as much as possible to provoke debate. These podcasts and responses aren't presented as authoritative. If you have questions, if you want to challenge things, or if you want to pick up on something and reflect on it, we'd love to hear from you. So we hope that you download again next week, and thank you very much for listening.